there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, presented by Purina Pro Plan. And right out of the bat, right out of the gates, I should say, I want to introduce the co-host for this episode, returning back to On the Wing Podcast, the Quail Forever Journal editor, Ryan Sparks.
Hey.
Coming at us from Nebraska now, making the move to the Great Plains. So we're recording over the interweb, and but we're going to go into some of Ryan's writing for Ryan to help us kick off and introduce this episode of On the Wing Podcast. And this bit of writing comes from the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever super issue that is in the mail as we speak. Ryan, take it away.
Yeah, you got it. In Sonoma County, California, where oak-dotted hills roll into sunlit vineyards bustling with quail, Passalacqua Winery is proving that wine pairs just as well with wild game and backyard grills as it does white tablecloths and crystal stemware. That vision evolved into Passalacqua's Pair Wild program, which celebrates the connection between handcrafted wine and wild food, whether hunted, foraged, or fished. But Pair Wild isn't just a catchy phrase. It's a practical guide for hunters, anglers, foragers, or anyone eager to elevate their wild game. And now, Quail Forever and Passalacqua Winery have joined forces to raise a glass to the uplands. And we have the perfect people with us to talk about wine and wild game and Passalacqua's recent collaboration with Quail Forever. Jason Passalacqua and Jessica Boone, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, let's start with the guy whose name is on the label. That seems like a logical place to start. Jason, first of all, we had a debate, Ryan and I, before we got on today. The proper pronunciation of your last name is what?
I should go back and ask all my teachers through elementary school. It's Passalacqua.
Passalacqua, okay. So tell us your story. What's your biography? Where'd you grow up? It sounds like you grew up, you know, somewhere in Europe, but your dialect doesn't tell us that, but give us a little bit of your background. Where
exotic
you're from
locations and throughout the world. Now, yeah. A great story to tell. And, just so we don't lose listeners in the first couple minutes, I'll keep it brief because it's not that exciting. So, I born and raised in Healdsburg, California, fourth generation Italian. My great grandfather came over from Italy with seven of his brothers, and you know, it's the story of coming through Ellis Island. They split up, and some went to South America, and some stayed on the East Coast, and a few of them made it to California. And the wine business has been in and out of my family for those four generations. He started a winery pre-prohibition and lost it during prohibition. Could have been an insurance claim, burned down, who knows what the story there is there. His daughter was one of the first female winemakers in California, and she made wine and shipped it back east in barrels on a train, which who knows the condition it was in by the time it got there. And, my dad's generation grows grapes. He's an attorney by profession, but he grows all of our Cabernet. And we bought the winery in 2003. It's kind of like a new thing on an old model for the family. But I grew up in Healdsburg, as I say, and, you know, hit 18. I couldn't wait to get away because, you know, it's about the time you know everything in life. Headed to school and then worked in Silicon Valley for about 10 years and said, you know, this really isn't for me. I prefer wearing jeans and, and boots and have my dog in my truck. So I was lucky enough to make the switch and buy this facility in 2003 and kind of start the label that had been It was a new label, but the Paso Agua name had been, synonymous with wine for, as I say, about four generations, three prior to me.
What did you do in Silicon Valley?
Oh, now we're getting into the boring part. I was a mechanical engineer out of school and was hired by an electronics manufacturing company. I think we are about 85,000 employees worldwide and, over a few billion in business in revenues, and nobody had ever heard of us. But we made everybody's stuff from, Cisco routers to HP computers and such. So I did new product introductions for them and then kind of transferred into their business development team, corporate development team, and was traveling too much. I mean, I flew to Japan for an hour meeting in the airport and then flew home, and I'm like, this is nuts. So it just really didn't fit my idea of what life was going to look like for the future.
Does owning a vineyard feel like the idea of life that you want?
That's a great question because it's layered. So the absolute answer is yes. But at the end of the day, we are a small business in, in America and in California, which is really, difficult place to do business. It's expensive, labor laws and, not going down that rabbit hole, but it's, we are a small business in, in a romantic industry, which is nice. I enjoy it. I enjoy the wine. I enjoy the people we meet. I enjoy the connectivity and viralness of the product. And I think that, there's a lot of days when you wake up and you're in the vineyard and the sun's coming up and you're like, this is my job.
Yeah. There can be elements, as I'm assuming, are very idealistic. But like you say, you're running a small business and it's got your name on it. So
you do.
You're the chief, what's that saying? Chief bottle washer?
And yeah.
Chief cook and bottle washer?
There's a lot of lessons I take out of corporate America, I think, that are applicable even in small business. And I remember we were making a decision to buy a company, and my boss then looked at me and said, this decision you're making, you're going to impact people's lives, and you are responsible for the longevity of your employees and their welfare. He's like, so do you still think it's a good idea? And I take that to our business at Paso Agua, even though we have six employees, but in terms of making payroll, work-life balance, quality of life, quality of work environment, all of that plays no matter how big of a business or small of a business you are.
Yeah. Normally I talk about hunting and dog backgrounds in the intro, but I know that's part of the origin story. So I'm going to hold that and we'll come back to that and introduce Jessica Boone into the conversation and ask Jessica, tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up being a part of the Paso Agua story.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me here. It's really great to talk with you guys. I grew up in Sonora, California, foothills to the Sierra Nevada. So I grew up hiking, backpacking, a lot of outdoor time, camping in the summers with my parents, putting up tents. but for college, I moved to Sonoma County to go to Sonoma State. Nothing to do with winemaking. I loved being outdoors, and so my degree was in zoology. I just loved ecology and biology. But so I got my degree in zoology, and my first job out of college was at the Fish and Game in Yountville in Napa area. The only opening was water quality, which wasn't what I was really excited about, but it got me outside twice a week pulling samples. And I was a seasonal employee, and what that means is I worked 9 months full time, and then I had to take 3 months off so they didn't have to give me benefits. Mm. So that 3 months off happened to coincide with harvest. It was August, September, October. And a woman I worked with at Fish and Game, she grew up in Napa, and she said, oh, I can get you a job at a winery. You can do lab work. They'll hire you in the lab. And I said, that sounds amazing. So yeah. I worked harvest 2000 at a pretty big winery in St. Helena. And it was super fun. It was the most fun I've ever had at a job. Harvest is exciting. There's grapes coming in and working crazy hours, and There's just an excitement that happens during harvest, and I was hooked. So I was just pulling samples, running analysis, and then after harvest, they offered me a full-time position in the lab, and I had that dilemma, what do I want to be when I grow up? And I ended up going with the really fun job instead of the rest of my life until I retire job. And it was the best decision I ever made. I started that after that harvest in the lab, and I would I'd get my lab work done, and then I'd go hang out in the cellar with the guys, and it was a crew of like 9 guys. I'm like, "Okay, teach me how to drive the forklift. What are you doing here? What's this? I want to help rack." I just was like, "Teach me everything you can." And so my boss, the winemaker at the time, of course, saw my enthusiasm and kept giving me more and more work and responsibility. So I worked my way up there. And then that was for till 2003. And then I took a couple years off and had a couple kids. And then in 2012, Jason was looking for a winemaker. And we had some friends in common. And so they hooked me up with a job with Jason. And I've been there ever since. It's the perfect size winery for me because I get to it's pretty much just me in the cellar. I get to do everything hands-on. I know every barrel, driving the forklift. I'm out in the vineyard. I have a little help during harvest, which is great, but I'm a control freak, so I get to control everything in my little domain.
It's always fun to hear, you know, talk to people in a new industry and get kind of the vernacular. I interviewed a meteorologist yesterday, and they're talking about, that person's a good Met. I'm like, what's a Met? You know, meteorologist. And, you know, the vernacular I'm picking up on with you is, yeah, you know, I'm kind of alone in the cellar, or you're hanging out in the cellar. It's like in the wine cellar. It's not something, you know, I got this vision of stomping on grapes and barrels, but it doesn't always
right. Oh, we exist. Do that, though. We do stomp on some grapes. It's hard work. It's harder than you would think.
So it's not machine operated these days, or is it still a little combo?
It is. There's a little. I feel like there's a little bit more of a freedom these days to experiment with different ways to make wine. I have a destemmer, so most of our grapes go through the destemmer. The whole clusters go in, separates the stems from the berries. But one wine in particular, the Fiano, it's a white grape from Italy, and I'd never made it before, so I wanted to make it 3 different ways, and one of those ways is to stomp on it, foot tread, and then you squeeze out the juice. So it's just like I Love Lucy in the you know. So it's fun.
You said, do you have a biology or zoology degree? Remind me.
Zoology.
Mm-hmm. Is that, I think, as you were talking about, you know, transitioning from that to being a winemaker, it's occurring to me that there's probably more similarities in that discipline, in those two disciplines, than maybe meets the eye for most folks. Because just the process of making wine is... there's a lot of science involved with it. Obviously. So my follow-up question, I'll hold that. Go ahead and answer the first question. the parallels between zoology and winemaking.
I like that. The biggest thing I gained from my degree is how to operate in a lab and knowing how bacteria and yeast work and kind of things like contamination and managing contamination, or what does pH mean, and what is all the background information to and the science behind making wine mean. When I took a handful of classes at Davis and Napa JC just to fill in the gaps on the science behind making wine, but it all just made sense really quickly. And then I think the other lucky piece is that I didn't go to school to make wine. So I didn't show up with a preconceived notion of what a professor at Davis thinks about making wine. My mentor who hired me, he always, he said, "I've never had a great wine made by a professor of enology," which don't tell anyone I said that, but
professor of what? What's the science of winemaking?
Enology is
Enology.
Yeah, it's O-E-N-O-L-O-G-Y. It's viticulture and enology, and viticulture is referring to the grape growing, and enology is the making of wine. But I'm a cook. I love to make things, and so there's that part of my personality that I think I was able to put to the forefront because I, as I say, didn't have anyone else's preconceived notions necessarily. It was like, this is how I think it should be done. I'm experiencing it myself instead of reading it first and then, you know, reading a recipe of all of the chemistry and then trying to make it. It was like, I'm just going to, I'm all in. I'm smelling, I'm tasting, I'm doing it. And that's how I learn best anyway.
Oh, that's a wonderful story because it leads right into the question that I bit my tongue on that I was going to ask. And that is, is winemaking more an art or a science? And if you were to take that, you know, that classic 100%, you know, what percent do you throw towards art and what percent do you throw towards science?
I think for me, most of it is art, and the science helps me keep that art contained and have nothing go wrong, or I mean, not that nothing's ever gone wrong, but to know my parameters of how to keep the wine from going bad, from turning, from going in a direction I don't want it to. So it's like the vision is probably more artistic and the experience is artistic and the science is there helping guide in a safe way.
Wow.
But for me, wine is very much an artistic expression. I have a good example. I had a friend of mine, another female winemaker, and we got the same grapes, same vineyard, same varietal, and picked on the same day. And half of it went to Passalacqua and the other half went to her winery. And we, you know, we're like, well, we're going to come together and taste these wines in a few months when they've settled down. And we did. And before we tasted, we talked about the process that we went through. And it was pretty similar if you lay it out on paper, step one, step two. Yeah, I did that. You know, a few things were minorly different. And then in tasting it, they were so different in the texture and the flavors and aromatics. And I was like, that's amazing because there's so many small decisions that we don't even realize we're making that impact the finished wine.
Who won?
Well, I think I did. I'm partial.
Yeah. What's the percentage of female winemakers these days?
The last time I heard a stat was quite a while ago. I want to say it's probably 6 or 8 years ago when it was maybe 20% of head winemaking positions were held by women. My feeling is that that's increased a bit over the years. I don't know how much. And usually women get pigeonholed into the lab, into enology.
Why is that?
I think it's because winemaking, at bigger wineries, which are most of them are not like Passalacqua. So a bigger winery, a lot of times the head winemaker is doing a lot of the sales and have that like charismatic salesiness. And not to say that women don't have that, but I think it's also kind of corporate America. And so there's obvious reasons that in corporate America, there's fewer women as CEOs. Also, at smaller wineries like ours, it's a really physically demanding job. If you don't have a lot of cellar people, you're climbing ladders and carrying heavy things. And I love that, but not every woman I know can lift 60 pounds and climb a ladder and do all of those things. I think there's a couple reasons. But I think the biggest one is that kind of corporate America dynamic that happens in the wine industry. It's a lot of corporations.
Well, I will transition us, give a shout out to ProPlan. And as we come back, I want to talk about kind of the philosophical approach to wine and the connection to hunting. Before we get there, I want to thank Purina ProPlan as the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission. And as I mentioned in the opening, the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. All of my pups eat Purina ProPlan, and it's not just because Purina supports our wildlife habitat conservation mission, which is incredibly important to me, and it should be important to you, But what's most important is that Purina Pro Plan has a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. It was created for the working bird dog like yours and like mine. You can learn more at ProPlansport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right. So as we transition to the connection with bird dogs and quail forever and the Passalacqua relationship, I want to start with Jason telling us the story of Passalacqua's wine and kind of your business approach, because it, to me, it feels unique and it feels different to the vineyards or the wine that I buy off the racks in Minnesota. Tell us about what you're trying to deliver to the consumer from a position in the marketplace.
Sure. It's a good question. I think when we started the winery, as I mentioned before, I had traveled extensively. And one of the reasons that I did not want to stay in that position was I no longer wanted to travel. And so selfishly, I said, you know what, I don't want to travel to sell wine. I never want to put a bottle of wine on the table and have to convince somebody to buy it or put it on their list. I never want to have to cut, you know, 3-case and 5-case deals. I want to sell all of our wine direct. I want to know our consumers. I want to have a personal relationship. I want people to have an emotional relationship with Passalacqua. And so that was the ethos of starting the winery 20 some odd years ago. What that does, it really limits your production, your scalability, your market cap, your, you know, how big you can actually get. Mm-hmm. But we were fine with that decision. We wanted to stay, you know, relatively small. We do about 5,000 cases right now. We sell it 100% direct. We're not on a store shelf. You'll never see us on a restaurant list. We rely on longtime customers. We rely on word of mouth. We rely on personal relationships. People come into the winery, taste, and purchase, which is a very difficult business model. Because if you think about, you just said wine off a shelf, you walk down the aisle, some fancy label catches your eye. It's got a shelf talker on it or a necker on it. You read it, you're like, oh, this looks interesting. You pull it off, you bring it home, and you're like, man, it's not that good. But you've already made the purchase. The store got their money. The winery got their money. For us, you know, you sit down at the winery, you sit on the deck, and you talk to one of our hosts, and you taste the wine. You understand, you know, how it's grown, where it's from, Jessica's ethos in making wine. And, you know, you make your decision after you taste it. And then you say, yes, I would like to buy this. So we've actually made a successful business model on that. And I think that, you know, it's kind of like the third-party endorsements. You know, when you read the reviews on Amazon, you know, if for 20-some-odd years we've made a business out of selling 5,000 cases a year and selling out of everything we make every year, all because people have tasted it and purchased it, it's a pretty good review.
Yeah,
but it is a bit different, right? We don't have the reach to, you know, put wine on store shelves across the U.S. So you'll never see Passalacqua or a lot of other small wineries here, you know, in wine country in Sonoma County that, you know, like me, don't have the reach to get their wines out there. The wine distribution model is another rabbit hole to go down. You know, there's really two or three big players that own it. You need to have really leverage with them in terms of relationship, breadth, you know, and SKUs in terms of price points, you know, and they have a book that's 3 inches thick, but there's really, you know, a handful of brands that consumers know because the brands, you know, submit for ratings and they submit for, they take advertisements out. And so, you know, they're doing their marketing and so they're easier to sell. So a brand like Passalacqua in a, you know, distribution model just would never get the visibility or traction.
So you found a niche going back to some of your roots as a hunter and a gatherer and, you know, your connection with bird dogs. Marry the two, kind of your outdoors background with your winemaking.
Well, you know, it was interesting. So Jessica, as she said, came on in 2012 and we, you know, probably early 17, 18, pre-COVID, all that, you know, scenario, we were, you know, we were doing a lot of hunting and foraging and such, and we just started to realize kind of this kind of epiphany where I'm sure, you know, everybody who's listening to this has tasted wild foods, whatever they are. And there's a purity of flavor in a wild food that you don't need A1 steak sauce. You don't need you don't need heavy marinades. You don't need heavy spices. I mean, they do work well, but you don't need them to get the flavor of the food that you're tasting, enjoying. And we realized that we were cooking, you know, simpler. We were drinking and pairing, you know, just unconsciously how the purity of flavor of wine and purity of flavor of food and how the two were coming together and how nuanced they were. And so we just started having fun with it and exploring it. And we cook a lot at the winery, and you know, you bring in elk, or I'd go forage for mushrooms and, you know, bring them in and cook them. And there's this, you know, we started watching this movement of farmers markets, organic, biodynamic, CSA boxes, and this whole idea of knowing from where your food comes. A term we use at the winery is know the source. And so all of that really came together in this idea of Pear Wild. And it really stemmed from fans, customers, guests, friends, hunting buddies, and all of them, you know, kind of pointing out that what we were doing and the style of wines we were making, and I'll let Jessica delve into that and why our styles, you know, pair well with wild game and wild foods. But they were saying and commenting and publicly acknowledging this connection between our style of wine and wild foods. And they could even be garden fresh foods, right? You don't have to lace up your boots and get out there. But and so we developed this concept called Pear Wild, and it's on the backs of all of our labels. And we identified, and we're still playing with it a little bit, 16 different wild food icons from, you know, upland and fowl and big game and seafood and, you know, mushrooms. And so we put together this program and this kind of identifier on the backs of our labels. And they're mere suggestions. I mean, I'll be the first to say there's a lot of wines that go well with wild foods. Pastillac was not the only one, but obviously we think it's the best. And then we've coupled it with how we prepare the food. Is just a basic starting point, right? You take elk, you pan sear it, you put a little salt on it, and you taste it with the wine. Now, obviously, if you put marinades and sauces on it, it's going to change the dynamic a bit. But it's an encouragement. It's a starting point, and I think a lot of people, you know, need a place to start.
And you've created these relationships with a whole bunch of writers and kind of the intersection of folks that hunt and fish and write about it. People that have been on this podcast or in the Quail Forever Journal, Jesse Griffiths, Jenny Wheatley,
right.
Ryan Sparks.
right. It's been fun because, you know, wine can be a very elusive, off-putting thing. And I think the wine industry continues to do it to itself in terms of telling people the right way and the wrong way and what you should be doing and what you should be drinking in the right glass. I read an article the other day of like three wrong ways to hold your wine glass. And I wanted to reach into the page and strangle the person that wrote it because I'm like, they're drinking wine. Isn't that good enough? But you know, now we're going to make consumers worried that they're holding their wine glass incorrectly. It's absurd. Anyway, I mean, I drink wine out of a red Solo cup, and I think I've shared this before. But the, you know, some of the best wine I've had has been out of a red Solo cup because I'm just finished something that I enjoyed doing. I was in a place where I really enjoyed doing it, and generally with people with whom I enjoy. And, you know, we poured some good red wine in a red Solo cup because we're sitting on the back of a tailgate, you know, having a piece of salami and some, you know, day-old bread, and it tastes great. And so it's all about, you know, how you want to enjoy it.
How many of our listeners right now are thinking about that closing scene in Sideways? Doesn't he drink wine out of a red Solo cup as he's eating a cheeseburger?
And there's nothing wrong with it.
No.
Right.
Just don't make me drink any Merlot.
Right, exactly. But, you know, but to that point, we did, you know, people started being interested in what we were doing with the Pear Wild scene. And one of the ways we really wanted to promote it, I feel like there's a large wild foods segment that sits on one side of the hourglass. And then there's the broader wine, food and wine world that sits on the other side. And right now, Passalacqua is the only winery that is making a claim and a statement that says we make wines that pair with wild foods specifically because we live a wild food lifestyle, and therefore consciously we make wines that go with that. And so I feel like we sit right in the middle of this hourglass, if you will. And I thought, how do we broaden the wild food scene into the wider food and wine world? And I think that, you know, there's chefs that are really interested and have signed on and contribute recipes to our website. We've partnered with some wild food purveyors who have wild meats or foraged mushrooms or seafood on their website, and they ship direct to your door. So, you know, you don't have to get up at 4 a.m. and put a heavy pack on and go after something. You can, you know, a couple clicks and have something shipped to your door and look on our website or other websites and get recipes, and open a bottle of Passalacqua and, you know, have that, you know, wild food wine connection.
Ryan, how did you initially get connected with Passalacqua?
I think just from being in the, you know, that wild game space, when I was doing more freelance writing, I kind of, one of my like little specialties was wild game cooking, just because for me, you know, hunting and fishing is sort of inextricably tied to, food, which is like ridiculous to say now, but like, you know, it's the original reason why human beings went hunting is to get food so we don't starve to death. It's always just been a big part of my life. And then when I learned about Passalacqua and we started doing things together, I just thought it was a really cool concept, and a lot of people they were working with, you know, I was already had relationships with and friends with, and I don't remember how we very first got connected. I think it was from maybe my friend Sammy Chang at Strong Sporting Journal maybe made the connection. So
exactly.
Thank you, Sammy. Yeah.
Thank you, Sammy, because that led to our partnership, which we're going to get into in a moment. I want to give Jessica an opportunity to kind of talk about that artistic and scientific approach to winemaking, and then throw the variable of wild game pairing to it. And, you know, give us your philosophical approach to that triumvirate of winemaking.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask too, you know, how do you go about making wine specifically for wild game? Like, what are the characteristics you're looking for in a wine that pairs well with game?
Yeah, for me, the word is balance, which is kind of a nebulous word, but in wine, I'm talking about all of the components are in balance. The oak, the fruit, the acid are meshed together without one taking over the other. And when I think about making wine for wild foods, kind of have like zoom way out and think of it on three components that I'm really paying the most attention to. The fruit or sweet and or lack of sweetness, residual sugar left in the wine, the amount of acid in the wine, and probably one of the most important being tannin. And tannin is that feeling when you drink a Cabernet and it strips the saliva out of your mouth, feels like. It actually does. Tannins are just these compounds that are found in a lot of foods, but in grapes. It's found in the skins and the seeds. And those tannins, when you drink wine, the tannins attach to the protein molecules in saliva, and it actually does have a stripping characteristic. So that saliva is really important in tasting food. It releases aromatic compounds, and like 3/4 of what we think we're tasting is actually volatile aromatic compounds having an impact sensorially. So for me, I need to keep the tannin in balance so I'm not stripping saliva, and therefore you can't really taste the meat. Like, think about a very common pairing is a big, thick, juicy steak with a big Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great pairing, but why it works, Cabernet has a lot of tannin. So in order to balance that, if you pair it with a steak, and that juiciness is really referring to the delicious fat that's in that steak, that fat coats your tongue and mm-hmm. therefore protects the saliva on your tongue. So then when you drink the tannic Cabernet, it's not adhering to those protein molecules and not stripping your palate. It's kind of, it feels softer. So it makes this big tannic cab seem a little softer. So kind of a cool pairing, but demonstrates why with wild game, which is pretty lean, not a lot of big juicy fat in venison or elk usually, I have to be really cognizant of the amount of tannin that's in the wine. And I control that in a couple ways. It's all of this is around harvest for the most part, because we extract those tannins from the skins and the seeds. I control how long the juice is in contact with the skins and the seeds, and depending on the varietal, because every grape has different amounts of tannin. So Cabernet is pretty high on that tannin level. Pinot Noir is pretty low. So I'm constantly monitoring and thinking about, like, okay, this wine that's going to be, it's Cabernet, is likely going to pair really nicely with venison and elk. So I need just enough tannin to give it structure and body, which, you know, tannin does positive things as well. But I don't want it to be so overpowering that it takes over the palate, strips the palate, and then you're not really going to taste all that cool nuance in the wild game. Another place we pick up some tannin is in oak barrels. So oak in red wine, in a lot of wines aged in oak, you pick up some really great flavor compounds, toasty kind of vanilla, but you're also picking up some tannin. So I'm choosing barrels based on how much tannin I want to extract, how long I want it in the barrel to extract more or less tannin. There's a million little decisions that can be made in just the barrel choice, from which cooperage it comes from to the toast level to the forest the oak comes from to the thickness of the grain, and all of those things kind of dial down to how much, how the wine is aging in oak and how much tannin it's picking up.
Wow.
The sweetness and the acid also have a big impact when you're pairing with wild game. When I'm deciding when to harvest is another huge component of that, the decision points, I guess. As the grape ripens on a vine, there's an opposite relationship with the sugar and the acid. So it starts out with a lot of acid and no sugar, these little green hard berries, and then as they color up and then as they continue to ripen through the summer, that acid falls slowly and the sugar levels climb. And as those sugar levels are climbing, the fruit characteristics are changing, and you can go from kind of a raspberry to more of a blackberry, say, or to a black cherry. And then if you let it hang on longer, you can eventually get to this pruny, porty, overly, you know, too much sugar, and then these other flavor components.
You tell when you pick a grape off a vine and, like, oh, today's the day to pick it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of things you're looking at, weather being a big one. But I am waiting for that, like, magical moment when the stars align and the acid is still there, but the fruit is just really coming into a great flavor profile that I'm looking for. And you get clues from the vines, too. The vines start to shut down a little bit. The leaves start to turn a little bit. And then it's, you know, I look at the weather. If it's ready, then, like, okay, as soon as we can get a crew out here. And I try to forecast, you know, week out, because we have to give people notice. But you kind of... Yeah, I go out and, like, hey, this will be ready in about a week.
Wow, that's fast. All right, so I'm going to ask, dial it back to a very rube question, and that's red versus white. You know, because so many people go, oh, I'm gonna serve quail a white meat, so I've gotta serve a white wine. And I know enough to know that isn't necessarily true. Tell us about selecting white versus red to pair with meats and wines.
Yeah, white is probably the safest choice for quail, but it again actually comes back to that whole tannin conversation. Mm. Quail is it's a delicate, sweet meat, and so if you have a really big tannic wine, it's gonna overpower the quail flavor. So I like a less tannic red. If you wanted to go red, like I said, Pinot has a lot less tannin, so you can do a softer, lighter red with quail. And then depending on what it's with, if you have something a little more substantial with it, can also hang out well with a light red. Even a lighter Zinfandel, we have a Zin we make from Russian River Valley, and it's a little higher in acidity, a little lower tannin than some of my other bigger Zinfandels. So it's certainly possible. And that's why I do the work for you, because you would never know that going into it. You would never say, oh, this is, you know, a Russian River Zinfandel from some other producer down the road. They're not making it intentionally to pair with mm-hmm. these wild meats. So it likely won't have the same reaction.
Well, it's a perfect transition because you created two wines for Quail Forever. Let's start with the red, the Quail Forever Red, which is a Pinot Noir. And the label features the Quail Forever 20th anniversary artwork of a bobwhite quail that was created by Krista Dawn. Tell us about building or creating or crafting the Quail Forever first ever wine that we've ever partnered with anybody on.
So exciting. It's super exciting. That Pinot Noir was the first Pinot that I started making for Passalacqua. It's from Anderson Valley. I've always loved Pinot from that area. There's a little bit of earthiness in that vineyard and in that area in general that I just love. And it really picks that. I've made a few dishes with the quail au vin. Was delicious.
From the super issue.
Yeah. Had to try that out and use a bottle of the Pinot in the cooking, and then probably while you're cooking, and then pairing it later.
It's a three-bottle recipe. It's a
three-bottle dish, okay.
Yeah. And it has a little bit of structure, but again, not too much, because it's Pinot, and I don't like it to be overpowering, again, as I say. Mm-hmm. So it's just really lush on the palate, has just a hint of oak, and it just makes the quail flavor pop.
That's terrific. And then the white, the Quail Forever White, which also has some fabulous custom artwork. And I'll be honest, I've never heard of this varietal before this partnership. And I may butcher the name Fiano. Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah.
Thank
I'll do it
goodness.
For you. Yeah.
Fiano.
I'll say too. I think the special artwork that you talked about on the Fiano, if I'm not mistaken, that was your artwork, right, Jessica?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
just
super cool.
A line, a pencil or pen drawing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. Well, that's funny. Sometimes we've played around with making a few labels, and we always have these ideas, and then have another artist try and pull it together, and where I was like, not quite right. I'm like, I know what I want it to look like. I'm just going to draw it.
Yeah, it turned out amazing.
Yeah, how many winemakers have their art in the bottle and on the bottle? There can't be too many.
No, that's a good point.
Well, tell us about the white.
So Fiano is a grape varietal that comes from southern Italy. So there's quite a bit of it. If you go to a restaurant in Campania region, it could be their house white. And not a lot of it grown in California, but we have a couple of vineyards that we found. And it's, I think, as I said earlier, it was the one that we foot tread. So it's, we found the varietal around here, and we're like, it's Italian, a unique white, which is fun, something new to offer our customers. And so it, when I brought it in, it was like, as I said, I want to experiment. There's no preconceived notion of what a California Fiano should be, so let's play around with what it could be. And I make it three ways. One of them being the I Love Lucy foot tread. one of them being going direct to press, just like a Chardonnay or Sauv Blanc. Usually the grape clusters go right into a press and squeeze out the juice. And so it's a much more fresh, vibrant flavor profile. And then the other component, I actually fermented on the skins completely. So like that's how a red wine is fermented on the skins to get some of that tannin. So there is just a hint of tannin from that skin contact and some really cool flavors that come out of the skins. So I have those three pieces, and then I kind of went through and just thinking about the quail forever and pheasants and what exactly is going to really showcase those flavors. So I came up with the blend, and it was really exciting. It's so beautiful with quail.
I've been amazed how versatile it is too. Like, I don't know if I've ever found another variety that pairs with a mallard duck and pairs with oysters and pairs with fried quail. I've been amazed. Like, sometimes it's like a joke. Like, we just pull something out of the freezer and it's like, I bet Fiano would be pretty good with this. We're going to have a bottle of wine with dinner. So
that's
so
hilarious, because we have the same joke.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's likely going to pair with the Fiano.
Yeah.
When you talked about the three different ways that you're preparing the kind of the flavor profiles for these grapes, are they sitting in three different barrels and then you take a percentage of them and mix them together?
Mm-hmm.
That's
like a fun part of being a winemaker, because I say I had four barrels of the skin contact and six barrels of the direct to press and then 10 barrels of the foot tread, and then you can kind of like dial it in exactly, you know, I'll put together blends and bring it in and have everyone try, like, what do you think, what's, you know, missing, do I need more of something? And it's super fun, but yeah, it's I can be exact with those because it's all broken out into separate barrels and awesome. Neutral barrels. I don't prefer oak flavor. I just want the container for aging in.
So this is a personal preference for me that I'm just curious about is the mineral taste in some whites I really gravitate to. You've talked about acid and tannins and sweet. Where's the minerality come from in whites? Which of the three components is that?
Yeah, that comes from the soil. It's that varietal in that particular soil and picked when the acid is still pretty high. I think you can then maintain that minerality when it's picked. So it's very site dependent.
And that tends to be like fish oriented for pairing. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. When you in looking at just in general, pairing food and wine, usually you're going down two different paths. The path is either I'm going to match the flavor and texture to the flavor and texture of the wine, or I want to take a food and kind of contrast a little, cut something. Like it. So say you had a really pasta with a creamy, buttery sauce. You could pair that with a Chardonnay, which is also pretty, can be creamy, a little buttery, heavier on the palate. And then those two, you have these matching flavor compounds and they kind of accentuate each other. If you go down the other path, you could choose something very crisp, like a Sauv Blanc, or there's many crisp white wines that would kind of cut through that heavy, creamy sauce, but still kind of accentuate it. They accentuate each other. You have the creamy sauce and then you have the Sauv Blanc, and it's like, oh, your palate's a little refreshed. And it accentuates how delicious the next creamy bite is when you taste it. So there's,
That's fascinating. Well, I could ask you guys about wine all day. Jason, let's transition. Tell us a little bit about why you made the decision to partner with Quail Forever, where conservation comes into this business ethos, but personal ethos for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was out this morning. I was thinking about this, this time, this podcast, and just how we have the path to get here, and so kind of similar in the question. And I remember taking my son to get his hunter safety class. He's like, "Dad, will you sit in the class with me?" So it was a night class, so we're sitting there, and day class, whatever. And so we're sitting there, and one of the points that is discussed is the transition of a hunter over a lifespan, and when you're young, you want to shoot anything that moves, and you want to, you just want to go out, you want to pull the trigger, you want to just want to hunt and kill. And then, you transition out of that at some point and into this, you're looking for specific types of, deer, or you want to go, hunt multiple species of quail, or you kind of start to, be a little more refined in your approach of what you're shooting or what you're hunting. And then you transition into this other piece, which is that you like bringing people out and spending time, and you still like to pull the trigger, but it's not about the bird count or the trophy count or something to put on your wall. It's just more about watching the dog work and just that, being there with people, mm-hmm. and that experience. And then they say you transition more into the conservation piece in terms of, I don't hunt anymore, I just like going out and seeing and supporting and such. And I was chuckling to myself because I'm certainly not in the conservation piece. I love going out. I'm kind of in the third phase. I like taking, my kids out and hunting with them. I like watching the dog work. I love calling. I love hiking. I love, looking for specific animals and such. But having the winery has allowed me to kind of work in the conservation space, a little prematurely. I do have gray hair, but not all gray yet. So, getting there, it allows me to, partner with an organization like, Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever, and do something that is positive in terms of conservation. And help raise funds and awareness for a good cause.
Yeah, well, we can't thank you enough. If you can't tell, we are jacked about this partnership. We've had some relationships with beer manufacturers in the past, but we've never had a collaboration with wine, and it is such a natural.
It is natural. And I was thinking about, the last question you were talking to Jessica about in terms of pairings. And, the first rule of thumb is always like, drink what you like, right? Because you can go, in any subject in this world, you can geek out on it and go deep and as deep as you want. But the main message that we have with all of our customers who come to the winery or with whom we ever share or talk wine is, you know what, at the end of the day, wine's a beverage. It goes, mm-hmm. It goes in your cup. It's a liquid. You drink it. You enjoy it. Whatever your relationship is with that is up to you. If you want to, explore and try the different pairings and try to figure out what tannins are and acids are and such, go for it. If you just want to, support, Quail Forever and, get a couple bottles and open up and be like, hey, this is good, and, drink it, and that's really the only thought you give it, that's good for you.
Yeah. And so I'll throw out some details for listeners. The Quail Forever wines with Passalacqua are in the Quail Forever Core Banquet Package for chapter events occurring right now through June of 2026. So for the entire year, if you go to a Quail Forever chapter banquet, there'll be a selection of these Passalacqua wines at your chapter banquets all around the country. And you can also buy this wine direct, as Jason mentioned. You can go to, I'll leave a link in the show notes for this podcast with a direct link to the Quail Forever page on the Passalacqua website, and a portion of every single bottle sold generates funding for Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. You heard me right. For the first time ever, when you drink wine, you're helping us create quail habitat. How about that?
You know, it's interesting. I got a call from one of our club members down in Texas, and he reached out and was like, "Hey, you know, I caught wind of this. You're doing this. It's a great organization. I'm a member of the local chapter." On and on. He's like, "Hey, if I got, you know, some of my buddies together, I could probably get, you know, 20, 30 people together. You know, would you fly down and, you know, pour wines for them and talk about this Pear Wild concept?" And he's like, "I don't know if they're members of Quail Forever yet, but we could certainly make them become members. You know, we could raise some money that night for the organization. You know, you come down and we can, you know, we can figure it out and we can put together some money for Habitat." And I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely, I'm in." Huh. So
that's awesome.
Know, as a sidebar, it's just wine, you know, wine, you know, kind of transcends those boundaries and allows, you know, for these creative things to happen.
Well, and you mentioned you wouldn't be able to find your wine on a menu in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. However, I know there's an awful lot of members of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever that do own restaurants around the country. If there was a restaurateur listening to this and said, "I'd like to buy cases of this for, you know, I've got an autumn quail special on the menu." Mm-hmm. Is that even possible? Could they contact you and get this wine for a restaurant?
I would certainly encourage them, you know, pick up the phone, give me a call at the winery, and we can talk about it. It really depends on where they are, because we have to go through a lot of states require distribution. So you have to go through a third party to get that handled, which is nothing is insurmountable. We can figure it out. And same with any listener out there that ever has a question about, you know, pairings or recipes or which wine they should purchase for whatever dish they're making, you know, pick up the phone, call me, call Jessica at the winery. Happy to talk to you about it.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And as I mentioned, I'll leave a link to the website, very specifically to the Quail Forever page on the Passalacqua website. A couple other bits of information. You know, you're probably hearing this thinking, "Oh gosh, this sounds great, but these are going to be, you know, $100 bottles." They're not. The Quail Forever White, $28, and the Quail Forever Red, the Pinot, $38. You can buy them direct on the website and get them shipped to your home in time for hunting season. I always have what I call pheasant feast, kind of a friends gathering around Christmas time with a wild game and, you know, different wines. And it's just a fabulous way to celebrate the hunt in friendship at the holidays. And I know a ton of people do something similar. Here's a way for you to add some wines to parties, dinners like that, and contribute back to the land. Conservation of the land that creates these birds and these memories where we chase our bird dogs around. So,
yeah, Jason, and to that point, you mentioned the pricing, but like the Quail Forever Red, we only made, I think there's only 120 some odd cases of it. So again, this is all small production, you know, small production wines. So there's, I'm hoping that we still have wine through June 2026.
Yeah. We're actually hoping you don't have wine through June. Let's sell it out.
Yep.
Well, we can make more.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say, too, for anyone that likes wine, I mean, like Jason mentioned earlier, like you have your grocery store wine that you go to. There is a whole nother world of wine out there where winemakers like, you know, Jessica and Jason are producing this incredible wine that, you know, to compare it to craft beer, for whatever reason, craft beer has like really figured out how to get into people's, like, well, how to get in their mouths and like be like, "Man, this is delicious." And I think if you taste this wine, I mean, you're going to be in trouble, because it's like opening, it really opens up your eyes to like what else is out there besides, you know, just your average, you know, if you're somebody that loves wine, but you've only bought like a $10 or $12 bottle from the grocery store, it's awesome. We're having like you said, I just moved back to Nebraska and we had some amazing friends help us move, and we're having a big thank you wild game feast. And actually right before this, I ordered some of our QF wine, both to drink and to give out as gifts at the at the dinner. So
I saw that. I saw that.
That's great.
Well, Jason and Jessica, thank you so much for not only your time, but, you know, having this philosophical approach to conservation and collaborating with Quail Forever. This is not only going to do great things, it's super fun too. And, you know, who doesn't like doing fun things as part of their job, you know, and a collaboration to put wine and good food and create memories on the table for our members is just fabulous.
Exactly.
As we wrap up, that's where I want to go to for final thoughts. Give some folks, you know, some ideas out here. Here's the question I'm posing for you, and we'll start ladies first. It's your proverbial last meal on earth. And let's not, you know, think about it as, you know, the death penalty or anything like that.
Yeah. Where am I? Am I in jail? Yeah.
You're not in prison, but it is your last meal on earth. So you get to decide, you know, what's that protein, what's the meat you want, your sides, your dessert, and of course, what wine are you going to wash it down with? And Jessica, you're on first.
Yeah, okay. It's such a difficult question because I absolutely love all food and all wine. Not all wine, sorry. But I love eating and drinking. So I love pasta. Who doesn't? But we've been playing around a lot with just recipes and obviously pairings and from all different sources of wild game chefs and recipes. And one I tried recently was an antelope ravioli and just a sage butter sauce. I think there's a little Parmesan with the antelope and homemade ravs, obviously. And it was maybe a bit time consuming, but it was so delicious. And so just the flavors of the sage made the antelope flavors pop. It was just delicious, delightful, all of the things. That with Pinot actually was one of my favorite pairings. And then I have to go to, I love hunting ducks and eating ducks. And my favorite is just a pan-seared breast over maybe a little rosemary, olive oil, salt, pepper with the Fiano. That was one of those kind of first surprising pairings, and a surprising pairing is always the best because you're like, I don't think that's going to go. And then you're just wowed by how they just complement each other so well and keep building on each other. I'm a fan
this
of
this. This is
dessert.
A big meal.
Yeah.
It's your last meal, Bob. This is going to go on and on and on and on.
And then. And then I also love tacos.
You're sitting at the chef's table for this one.
Yeah, and then I have to say dessert is something like an apricot in a pastry with a Tokaj. A Tokaj is a Hungarian sweet wine.
I want a seat next to you for this meal. That was fabulous. You know, it's how you mentioned antelope pronghorn. You know, it is.
I wrote that down.
That is so underrated. From a wild game meat, there's so many people it's too gamey and they didn't take great care of it because you gotta get it cooled down right away, but boy, when you do, boy, that just pops. That's fabulous.
We'll get to that recipe, Ryan.
I
wrote it down. It's gonna happen. I got some in the freezer right now. So
how many courses on your last meal, Jason?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you made her go first because it gave me some runway. And I was sitting here thinking, and then I thought, well, my criteria is like, what time of year is my last meal? Because if I can pick tomatoes out of the garden and do a, you know, tomato and burrata with some basil over the top, that's definitely on the table. With some, you know, crusty French bread, that's great. You know, if it's early May and you get, you know, some pan-seared, you know, rainbow trout that are like 6 inches, they're like French fries, and you can eat the whole thing, you know, rolled in Wondra and then, you know, fried in a little Crisco or oil, that's good. You know, I love the duck on the rotisserie, or I've also just, you get an elk burger with some caramelized onions and some chimichurri on on a potato roll. Super tasty. Those would probably be on my short list. And there's a smattering of beverages. It's like I said, if it's in the wintertime, I drink bourbon. In the summertime, I drink vodka. It's just, I'm pretty seasonal with my food and beverage.
You do know you own a vineyard, though.
Oh, yeah. You got to start. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they're like, don't you drink wine? I'm like, yeah, but if I got here and I wanted a beer first. I wanted a beer, and then I'll transition into wine. It's kind of, it's situational.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, take us home. What is the Ryan Sparks final? And you probably are in prison for this one.
Yeah, and I'll mention too, it's we're recording this, and it's Friday about 5 o'clock, and I'm just drooling thinking about the corks I'm gonna pull here in a little bit and the food we're gonna have for dinner. Yeah, and you're talking to somebody. I mean, it's sitting right here. I had to laugh. We're talking about the last meal. This is my wife and I sat down last night and planned that thank you friends dinner. Mm. I literally have 3 pages of notes on the things that we're going to make. And so I had to condense it for this question. But, probably some fried Bob White quail with a tray of oysters If it's my last meal, a really big bottle of white wine, the Fiano would probably be great with that. And then probably a wood duck, just seasoned with salt and thrown on the grill, skin on. And another really big bottle of red with that, probably a Pinot and duck.
I like the big bottle.
Yeah, like a Magnum I don't know how, if you can get bigger than that. I think there's one called like a Nebuchadnezzar, and they go up from that in sizes. So, yeah.
If it's your last meal, it doesn't matter how you feel the next day.
Right. Yeah. And then dessert. I have always loved my grandma's bread pudding recipe. So probably that with like a dessert wine of some kind, like a Vinsanto or something like that, would be fantastic.
So, boy, it is time for all of us to go. Would you say pop some corks?
Pull some corks.
Pull some corks. Yeah, I don't have the lingo down yet. We're gonna have
that's
to go
from
pull
my
some corks.
My grandpa. That was his polite way of saying if somebody was a drunk, he'd be like, yeah, he's been known to pull a cork.
Well, we hope our listeners pull lots of corks. Would you say 150 cases of the red?
120, 121. I just
123.
All right, yeah. There's your notice. Get on it. They are now available. The link in the show notes, but you can go to PasaLacquaWinery.com/quailforever, and you can have a look at the two wines, the artwork, and there's a fabulous video on the webpage too that tells the story a little bit of what we just talked about. But I want to just once again thank you all for the collaboration, for the partnership, the commitment to conservation, and in sharing the time on this episode of On the Wing podcast. Been a lot of fun.
It has been. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's exciting to be a part of.
Yeah, well, check it out, folks. I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog, even if it's to a winery. You might find some quail and something to wash those quail down with. Always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.